Welcome to Casterbris. I'm Christian Corley, and this time I'm joined by James McLean and Brian Terranova for a conversation that starts with a peculiar discovery about Luke Skywalker's trousers and then ends up somewhere rather different. We're talking Star Wars and Doctor Who restorations, props and continuity, fan edits, and whether new technology might eventually let all of us create our own preferred versions of the films, television, and even music that we love. Which begs the question, are we all going to end up watching different versions of the same thing?
Do you know what I learned the other day?
What's that?
Which I didn't know. In Star Wars New Hope,
yes.
Luke Skywalker's outfit, his trousers, Brian knows this already,
yes.
Were bleached out jeans.
Yeah, I just learned it as well, yeah.
Really?
I didn't know that, yeah. So they just beat out
Levi's jeans.
Levi's,
right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So these are the ones he's wearing on Tatooine at the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. Well, what's funny is after learning that, I just saw a photo of Han Solo. I was trying to get reference for his blaster again, and beautiful HD quality. You can see that his trousers are just jeans as well, that they put the stripes down.
Well, the black ones.
Both of them are just jeans. Black. Well, they're not black; they're blue.
Oh, they're blue.
His New Hope ones. They're blue with the red dash stripe down the leg.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, well, of course that makes sense. If Mark's were jeans, why wouldn't yours be?
Yeah, sure. You know? The thing is, I mean, we're obviously in danger of getting off Doctor Who here. But the thing with Star Wars is that there's so many
Doctor Who. We already are. Go on.
There's so many different prints. And we've seen so many different prints over the years in the UK. There's some of the ones that they used to screen on TV were of such poor quality compared with when the THX ones came out in the early 90s, and we were beginning to see what it was supposed to look like as opposed to what had been screened on TV, which was very shoddy and very bad, poor quality and degraded quality because it'd been shown loads and they took a copy off something that had probably been at the cinema several times or whatever. So, it changes, and that's a great thing with any restoration, whether it's a movie or Doctor Who. I've just heard that they've found the Hammer Frankenstein has had lost footage reinstated into the movie for the 4K release that's coming out.
Oh, really?
And this is a great thing about these things, isn't it? That we get new things, and it enables us to look at the things in a new way. The same things that we've looked at hundreds of times, certainly in the case of Star Wars or Doctor Who, and see them in a new way without someone coming along and saying, actually, this guy shot first. You don't need that.
No, you don't need that.
But
isn't that the
argument, though? Isn't that the beautiful argument about rewatching things every time you rewatch?
Yeah.
Yes.
Like layers, perhaps, is it, where it's just, you're building on those previous watches, revisiting those previous thoughts. It's never the same. But yeah, sorry, Brian.
No, I basically went down a rabbit hole after seeing what they did with the restoration of the TV movie in HD, mm-hmm. which, by the way, looks amazing. I don't know if you guys have seen it.
I don't have a UHD player yet, but I'm planning to get one.
We're back on
Doctor purely for that.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it looks great. There is, I read kind of like a breakdown of the restoration, and there is one sort of visual effect that's missing. I say sort of visual effect because they call it a visual effect, but it's not really a visual effect. It's literally one film insert that's missing, and it's when the Seventh Doctor has the chest X-ray done, and they flash the X-ray up on the screen. So the machine itself flashes, but in the flash was the chest X-ray. The chest X-ray is gone. They forgot to put that in. And it was funny because when I watched it, I thought what I read was that the flash was missing. And when I saw the scene, I was like, oh, the flash is there. What are they talking about? Never even occurred to me that the chest X-ray was missing. Like that's how much I didn't miss it, right? Everything else looked so beautiful. So it's a bummer that it's gone, but everything else is really great.
So that sounds like it's an actual reconstruction then.
Yeah, so that's what they did. They went back to the original film negatives. They had to use some upscaling, I guess AI upscaling, of stock footage. And they probably redid some visual effects to make them match the era. Because they all look identical to me. I watched a side-by-side comparison. They just look cleaner and better and so on. So, yeah, they went back to the original negatives. This is the first time that we're finally getting this thing in the clarity that it was made in. But the rabbit hole that I was talking about actually brought me back to the Doctor Who movies. There's something I didn't even know about this. James, you might know about this because you're the film guy. But I don't know what it's called. But the type of film that they used on the Doctor Who movies means that we'll never get like a 4K version of them, at least not without AI. They can only go so far because they just did an HD, like a 1080 restoration not that long ago. And the reason for that is they used a particular type of film that instead of taking one anamorphic shot, it in that same frame that would, and you know what the anamorphic is, it takes like the regular frame size and squeezes it to fit into the block. In that same frame shot, they fit two frames in one.
Oh.
So because there's two in one, it's lesser quality when you're trying to restore it. The picture quality isn't as beautiful. Mind you, I was watching the second movie recently and it looks incredible. But it'll just never be better than that because of the type of film that they use to save some money for it, which, I mean, who can blame them? But it looks great. It's not like it's any great shape. Like, it's not harming me at the 4K, not 4K rather, but at 1080, it looks really great. But I didn't know that. James, do you know what that's called when they do that?
I don't know. I must admit that.
I can't remember the name, but it was really interesting. It was just on YouTube. Since I had watched all these things about the restoration of like various Doctor Who stuff, that one popped up and I was like, all right, yeah, let's check it out. And I'd never heard of that there was film that did that.
I wasn't aware of that either.
Yeah. But there you go. You're learning new things about old stuff again,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, that's it, isn't it?
I mean, it blows my mind that I think back to when we talk about this sort of evolution of seeing things in better quality, how you go to like the early 90s and you get this push of having widescreen letterbox on video and DVD. And yet we all had like 4:3 ratioed sets for these 69. Uh-huh. So you'd have just really was literally a tiny strip across.
Yeah.
And it was better quality. We got to see stuff which pan and scan wouldn't allow us to see. Yeah. That was the limitations of the technology to see the proper stuff is incredible. And you think that was what it was because no one had massive TV sets. You know, you might be sort of, if you were lucky.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I saw
probably the max that I had. Sorry.
Yeah. I was going to say the first time I saw a big TV set, it was probably only like 40 inches.
Hmm.
But, you know, it was probably almost 40 inches deep as well. And it was
they're huge.
Yeah, they were huge. This was about 1981. Yeah. It was the house of a family that didn't have children. So they were the only people who had big TVs in those days.
Yeah. Yeah. And everybody, when anamorphic was a thing, when they first started doing that, letterbox rather was a thing, everybody lost their minds. Like, oh, we're lost picture. What are you talking about? These black bars. I can't watch a movie with these black bars. And like you try and explain to them, but you're gaining picture. You're not losing picture. And they're like, but I'm losing the whole top and bottom of the screen. And it's like, yeah, technically you're not using that half, but you are still getting more picture and it's such a mess. And now most people seem to thankfully like it, but I just remember what a pain in the butt that was trying to get people to understand this is better when they all wanted to put on the one that filled the 4x3 screen.
But this is what's so frustrating, isn't it? Like I just went on to see if I could see about the film technique, found a website on Doctor Who and the Daleks, and they are now, I'm seeing little diagrams of specificities between the Daleks in the 64 to the movie Daleks, which I hadn't noticed before.
Yes.
Not obviously the bumpers and everything, but down to the sort of nodule placements. And I can see, right, after this is another bloody rabbit hole I'm going to be going down. You know, when you talk about the blaster, I was thinking about Han Solo's blaster and the rabbit hole you can go down there to the various different prop versions over those three films alone. Especially that weird one in Return of the Jedi with the very long barrel. Brian will know what I'm talking about.
I 100% know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, there's a really weird one in Return of the Jedi, and then there's the Greedo killer, the really weird one in A New Hope, because they had to refilm bits of that scene in America, and they couldn't get the weapon from England due to like weapons laws and regulations, because it was a real decommissioned German Mauser. That I only recently learned they had dismantled after the film, restored it back to being a regular Mauser. I don't know how they did that because there's holes in it and so on. And then they repurposed it to use in other films. That's why it wasn't used again in that configuration. But I have a replica of the regular A New Hope one, not the Greedo killer, but the hero A New Hope one. But there's a dial on the scope that I watched a video with Adam Savage where he was comparing his to a colleague of his from back in his Lucasfilm days. And the dial was more brass than it was black. And I'm like, man, mine's all black. And I'm like, should I weather this? And I'm like, well, now I want more high quality photos of the New Hope blaster to see, like, what did it really look like when Harrison was using it? Because I used to love the Empire Strikes Back one. That one and Jedi, they used to be my favorite. That was ingrained in my memory. Same but here. The A New Hope one is so much more intricate. It's so much more interesting now to me as an older guy, I guess. I don't know. But I understand why they changed it. Because obviously they couldn't use it because they decommissioned it and they took it apart. But the way it's designed, it has this metal bar that holds the scope, and that really digs in your hand. And when they did the Empire and the Jedi one, they built it upward so that it won't touch his hand. So I think they changed it with good intent. And I do like the nozzle on the Jedi and the Empire Strikes Back one. So I don't know. I might get a replica of them as well. But yeah, I like mine. I just now I'm like, should I weather that thing?
Because something which doesn't happen with Doctor Who, but does happen with Star Wars. Two things which have really hurt me with Star Wars, which makes it hard to watch for me now. And I'm sure, Brian, I'll have you on side on this. Christian will be thinking, when are we getting to talk about Series 2 of Doctor Who? What is this? So like, so let's take Return of Jedi. The hero prop for Luke's lightsaber and how it shifts constantly through the film. That I found hard. And then obviously the other big one, has he deliberately done that? Has he deliberately gone back? Oh, very clever. Is the Millennium Falcon, you know, being like 3/4 scale, the actual full size one?
Okay.
You wouldn't actually.
We're going to go down a real rabbit hole here.
That bugs me. Yes. So if people don't realize this, just to destroy you if you love Star Wars, but in all the films, not just the new sequels, which people have issues with, the actual built Millennium Falcon is too small. You would not have the headroom for it to work. And I find that really difficult.
Yeah.
And that it doesn't just extend to Star Wars. There are other things. Even in the Star Wars games, the old Knights of the Old Republic games, the ship would be smaller scaled on the exterior world to the interior world when you go inside it, interior map. And that would bug me as well. But Doctor Who's never really bothered me like that. I don't think at any point, even though there are so many inconsistencies through that TV show, it doesn't upset me. And yet, And I can't tell if that's because the essence of Doctor Who is far more fluid in itself, or is it the way that I watch Doctor Who means that, or is it because Doctor Who has points where it is so basic in its visuals that you've just learned to accept what you see?
You know, it could be that Doctor Who has always been sort of more cheap and cheerful to us, right? Like we accept these things as part of it because we're not necessarily watching it for that kind of continuity or level of budget or whatever. We're watching it for the characters and the story, right? Like for example, I love there's versions of the TARDIS prop that I love and versions of the console room, the sonic screwdriver and so on. But a lot of those things also change quite a bit. I mean, how many versions of the console room did Pertwee end up having? You know, while they were trying to figure things out, right? And it never really sat there and was like, oh God, this bothers me. It's not the same as last time, right? But like you pointed out, I have a replica of Luke's lightsaber, the hero one, right? And we call, for those who don't know, and I'm sure a lot of listeners probably do, but for those who don't know, the hero prop, that's the one that they wanted the camera to see. That's the one that really doesn't get used too often, certainly doesn't get used really heavy duty because they don't want anything to happen to it. They don't want it to break. It's for beauty shots. It's for close-ups. It's for scenes where the character may be holding it but isn't going to use it for battle, but they want it to look really great, right? That's the hero prop. Anything else is a stunt prop or a purpose-built prop, right? Stunt prop, you can throw, you can drop, you can bang around. Purpose-built, they're the ones with the spinning blade or one that maybe has to break in half or open up, show the power crystal, right? Anyway, long story short, I have the hero prop Luke Skywalker replica, and I like it. It's great. But when you watch Return of the Jedi, your focus kind of has to shift on what you think is the hero prop, because we know the hero prop is the beautiful, pristine one, right? The other one that he uses is a repurposed Obi-Wan Kenobi lightsaber from A New Hope. They reworked it, repurposed it to be a Luke Skywalker one. And it's so beat and weathered and worn and doesn't really look like his hero one. It's close, but it's not identical. It's so weathered and worn. And it's the one that he ends up using the most in Return of the Jedi, because that was used for the beauty shots, the hero one. You have to then sit there and go, okay, well, I know it's the hero one because you tell me it's the hero one and it's the beauty one, but he really used the other one 90% of the time. Shouldn't that at this point be the hero one and the other one be known by something else, right? And I know that's not how it works, but that's how it ended up, right? So now I find myself trying to do like what you did, reconciling with the Millennium Falcon. Here I have this lightsaber and I love it and I think it's great, but it's not really the one that he used ultimately, you know, like a couple of shots, yeah. But the one that he used actually looks so Star Wars because of how beat and lived in and weathered it is. It looks so great, even though there's a wonderful deleted scene where he actually finishes building the lightsaber. I don't know if you've seen that, but if you haven't, look it up, but you have. But it's great. I think they should have left that scene in it. That scene, and I really wish that they left the scene when they escape Jabba's palace and they're in that sandstorm. Oh, I've always loved that scene. And Lucas just thought, oh, it doesn't work. It's not, you can't see anything. It's a sandstorm, man. It looks incredible. It worked perfectly. You're not supposed to. It looks so good. It's such a great scene. So, yeah. So those are the kinds of things that bug me. It's kind of the same mindset, right? I watched it. It's such a big budget movie. And Lucasfilm, they're amazing at building the props that they make. I mean, you know, one of his remits was that everything was supposed to look lived in. It was supposed to be a real universe, which is why Star Wars sells so well. But then you get those things that take my eye as well. And I don't know, is it because of that big budget and we're expecting more? Is that what it is? We're just expecting more from them? I don't know.
I feel like we were almost brainwashed with Doctor Who. So like in Matt Smith's era, so many times the 3D asset that they would use for the special effects was still clearly the old Tenant box, and they hadn't updated it. And you see it, and you just go with it. And I think you go with it if you're people like me and Brian. If you're Christian, like I said, you're just thinking, why are we not talking about Series 2? But for me and Brian, we're thinking, I suppose, because we're so conditioned not to find that unacceptable anymore. Because, like, you know, back in the 70s, you'd have that horrible tiny box-like thing on a string which would spin around for Tom Baker, which will look nothing like the main prop, the built prop, that you just had to just accept it. And while with Star Wars, you had it was a bit like that. See, you can contribute to this, Christian. You can help things.
There's a Hartnell story. Maybe there's two. God, I watched it recently. The TARDIS lands. And it's like, it's literally this big, like they didn't build a big, they had one, but like for this one story, like the model is like this big and you just roll with it. Like that, yeah. That is it.
Well, the modeling spearhead from space doesn't look like it's particularly big either.
Well, the one that they then do a straight cut to.
Yeah.
Which is really weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
At the beginning of Spearhead, you have the TARDIS materialized. And it's got a proper slanted top roof.
Yeah. And then there's a jump cut to the prop.
Yeah.
I don't. That's amazing. I don't remember that. I'm gonna have to watch that.
You are gonna have to watch that
because I just watched that recently. And I'll tell you what I did. What I watched the end of War Games in Color, mm-hmm. because I really like that that regeneration that they did. The guy who did that, I forget his name now, unfortunately, but did a really good job with that. That was really good. That was really fun. So I wanted to watch the two blending together, but he does this kind of like pan across the terrain.
That's why
that was in Spearhead.
Yeah. The pan, I think, has been introduced to do this. There's some merging of the pan distracts from the model drop or model shot, or something happens. Well, maybe what it is, maybe there's a freeze frame of the prop before Pertwee comes out of it, and they're panning to the freeze frame. Maybe that's what it is. But
yeah, well, I think
go on.
I think you're onto something, because if I'm not mistaken, do we even see the we see the model materialize.
Originally,
and then we see Pert, we fall out of the box. Yeah. And I think that's what the pan is for, because he made the actual box materialize.
Right.
Right.
However he made that wood landscape look realistic. Because I truly just thought he used that shot. He did such a good job on
that. Yeah, it's a very good job.
Do you think with Doctor Who, we're in a point now where, like with War Games, as you say, there's almost like two different versions of that story. There's one where it's heavily infused now that this is the Master. In a previous incarnation, we have a proper regeneration. We have the original, which is a very different thing. But I feel now Doctor Who is in a very clever place. Well, it probably right now isn't, but in theory, it's in a good place. So far as, like, I was watching the Destination Dalek short for the box set.
Oh, right, yeah.
And then they did the comic that I've not actually, you've probably got the comic, Brian. You still do Doctor Who Monthly, don't you?
No, I don't anymore.
Oh, you don't? But they released a comic, didn't they, that followed up off that trailer?
You're talking about the Peter Davison one?
Yes.
Yeah.
But isn't that interesting? We're in a point where we have this trailer where he lands as an old Doctor with an old Tegan, and they go on this adventure. They get caught by Daleks, and it's Turlough and everything. And it is, in a sense, canon, not canon. It's like it doesn't matter canon, almost. And it's so funny when you see people still getting angry that they can't put Doctor Who into a proper continuity. Because I saw there was one post I was looking at yesterday about people complaining about... it was an interview with Sylvester McCoy talking about his time and how he was... about the other, and this idea of there being the three big people and the Doctor coming from that third thing that they sort of introduced. Right. And he loved the way that Chibnall, with a timeless child, kind of did that sort of thing. And there's people in the below the line just going absolutely ballistic, going, you know, both of them are wrong, or Lunk Barrel's never canon, or I should be able to have a straight continuity. Why can't I have a straight continuity? It's like, well, Doctor Who is clearly a space where we can't. And as we've said many times in 15 years, it's a time travel show, it's time changes. But now we've got this actual level of, like, Doctors living on in a weird sort of pseudo-continuity, which is not even about time changing. It's about, I don't know. I just think it makes watching things like the War Games a lot of fun, because you don't have to sort of sit there and go, is this now canon? Was the Master at this point the War Chief? You can just sit and watch and go, these are two variants of stuff, and I can be all right with that, surely.
They're definitely variants. I agree with you on that. And it is kind of like choose your own adventure almost now. And I got to say that the colorization work is beautiful. It really gives me hope for Invasion of Dinosaur Episode 1. We talked about that before, that they will do a great job with that. But that trailer with Peter Davison, I want to talk about War Games again in a second here, but that trailer of Peter Davison, I was actually pretty upset. Not upset, but I wasn't as excited, I guess is the better way of saying it, as everybody else when that came out. It was fun. But the reason I wasn't as excited is because we've had what is now called Born Again with David Tennant, Series 2, there you are, Christian. We had Time Crash, with David Tennant and Peter Davison, right? 7-minute shorts that are in essence complete scenes, like that portion. Time Crash is a complete story. We'll just say that. Born Again, really, I've said it for years, should be part of Christmas Invasion, but it's a great in between the two stories. It works unto itself. So what bugged me about that Peter Davison scene is, they had this time, they had all this effort that they put into this thing, and they give us a cliffhanger that was literally going to go nowhere. And only because people were like, oh, I want to see where more of the story went, then they made a comic out of it. And it's like, you could have done a 7-minute short thing. Like, we would have lapped that up completely. Now it's a trailer, and if you want to finish it, you read the comic. And that's fine. You know, that's just how life goes sometimes, you know, but it's like, I would have loved if they just tacked on another like 2 minutes, you know, up that budget a little bit. How much would that have killed them? They already did so much of it, you know. That's just me, though. Other people really love it. I have a friend who actually was in it and made the sonic screwdriver prop for it as well. So I'm not knocking it. It is great. It was a lot of fun to see. I did enjoy watching it, but when it ended on a cliffhanger and I was like, oh, is there going to be another, like, is part two on the box set? And I found out it wasn't. I was like, what? Why are you doing that to me? You know, like, it didn't make sense. But the War Games, my preference personally is going to be the black and white version, because I think the color version, while it looks beautiful, I think they cut it too short. Certain things happen far too quickly or nonsensically, if that makes sense, in my opinion. But I love that ending. So what I did was I actually made my own edit, where I took out the 10th, 11th, and 13th Doctor. Yeah. I got rid of all of them. I put the original photos back. And I made a little edit. I made myself a little film. I did like a Tobey Maguire doing his prequels edit. Not Tobey Maguire, Topher Grace doing his prequels edit thing. And I made a little short film out of just the trial portion and the regeneration. This way I have a scene that bleeds in between the War Games and Spearhead from Space. And why I mentioned Topher Grace is because it's probably one of those things no one's ever going to see, because much like Topher Grace, how do I put that out there? That's not my original work. I just edited this thing, you know, for my own amusement and entertainment. But it's fun seeing it in color nonetheless. They really did do a good job with that.
Do you think that's a future? Because I've always said, and I say this proudly to people, I take songs which I like but aren't quite right because the artists haven't got it right, and I'll take and I'll edit them until they are as they should be. So I don't tend to use things like Spotify because I need an MP3 player to play the songs in their proper form, which I have decided and edited together. My point being is there a future where, like, media is so much more, because we're going so much, we're obviously going down personalization every year. Everything's personalized to a point where can personalize your decision making, or it becomes aware that that's what people will do.
There is the, like, I can't remember what it's actually called. It's like a share and mix feature on YouTube, isn't it? So, like, when I upload this video to YouTube, I will have the option of checking a button or not, a radio button, selecting that whether someone can, like, remix the video. So that is a thing that happens. Personally, however, I have to say, I think what you've just described is probably the closest thing I've ever heard to Satanism in a conversation. It's in the sense, it's the most evil. I can't believe you do that. I'm absolutely like, bang, mind blown. You actually take other people's music and edit it into a more palatable form.
Into its correct form, yeah.
But you declare is correct, though.
Well, obviously, yeah, it would be correct if I hadn't actually decided it.
That's just it. I, funny enough, earlier on today, I came across there's some guy who somehow, I don't know how, has got copies of. There might be more to it than this, but in this instance, session recordings from Queen's "The Miracle." Now, the Miracle album, I think, is a terrible album. Largely, it's probably got about 3 or 4 decent tracks, and the rest of it's not very good. If compared with like Innuendo, it's just not the same quality at all. But there are some good songs on it, and Breakthrough is one of them. And there is the single and album version of Breakthrough starts off with like a choir bit, and then it bounces into the song. And this person's presented it as a session tape that doesn't have the beginning bit and just starts off with the keyboard, and then the drums come in and the drums are too high in the mix compared with the original. And there's some vocals missing, you know, like choir vocals missing, but whatever. And very kind of interesting to listen to, but I don't know whether that's real or not. I don't know if that's genuine. It could have been constructed from the song that already exists. Excuse me, I'm going to go. But I, as I say, James, I think what you do is absolutely abhorrent. That's just... There should be, I mean, there needs to be some sort of UN resolution. You cannot do that. No. No.
Why not? Why not?
I don't know.
Yeah, interesting. I've had people say that. I mean, I've had people say, when I've said to music, say, I would come for you if you did that to my film. So I understand. I mean, obviously, this is like for personal, as you
say. You've told other people this thing?
Yeah, I tell them all the time.
I'd keep it quiet if I were you. This is like admitting that you have a subscription to Pirate Bay or that thing that my dad uses for sport.
Why?
I just think it's wrong.
Well, they're two different things. Pirate Bay is about people selling or moving copyright, not selling, but the distribution of material which is not meant to be transmitted. All I'm saying is people who've done this. I mean, how many people like when I was a kid and we didn't have stuff, like there would be bits of musical scores which I'd record off the TV so I could listen to on a tape recorder because there'd be no other way to actually get that piece.
Hang on, I think I want to go more into this. What is your actual process for this then? What do you do exactly?
Well, I would be a 7-year-old child with a tape recorder.
No, now, what do you do now? Do you take a piece of music? Did you load it into like Audacity or something? Have you already made notes about what you want to change? Do you have like a long list of timestamps that you're going into, or are you just making like a radio edit for James's head?
So series two. I don't really remember any series two. I have Teeth and Claws one I didn't particularly like. My process is my own. In terms of like why I do it, I think there's a kind of like a neurodivergent thing going on. You'll see people who will on YouTube, and they'll legitimately do this, they'll have a loop of a song going for like 10 hours. I can do that. If a song really clicks with me, I can have that sitting on play for like 5-6
There is a version of Trollololol.
Yeah.
That goes on for something like that. The famous Russian song. That people watching don't know what it is. Anyway, and there's a looped version of it that goes on for 16 hours.
That's what happens. Yeah. I think my point is, if I'm going to be serious about this, which I like to.
Well, I am intrigued about it. I know I've been a little bit flippant before, but the whole thing isn't. Yeah. Cause, I mean, like okay, everyone did. I mean, we used to do radio edits with cassettes, didn't we? I mean, if your cassette didn't. If you wanted an album on a cassette, you know, you got the vinyl, you want to put it on cassette, but the vinyl's a bit longer than the cassette or whatever.
Okay. Let's take a song. Does anyone know the song that Robbie Williams and Kylie Minogue did, Kids?
Yes.
That was in the early mid-2000s, the two of them did.
No, but I'm still following. Go ahead.
Robbie Williams, at the very end of it, does what I think is deliberately the worst rap he can do to back end the song. It's absolutely awful. I think he knows it and he's having a bit of fun. Now, invariably, if you like that song, one thing you might want to do, you might not want to have to listen to that song, that rap at the end. If you had, especially now where it's not on tape, you have things on loop, what would you do? You might want to remove that element that causes you displeasure, personal displeasure. You might be aware that other people might love it. Robbie Williams might think it's great. And you're absolutely all for creative outlets, and that is the decision he's made. That's what he's put out into the world. Absolutely fine. But personally, for your enjoyment, you might have that removed. That's a really, really simple thing.
Okay. So I'm pretty sure Robbie Williams thinks everything that he does is amazing. However, James, I have absolutely come round to your way of thinking on this. No criticism whatsoever. I take it all back.
Kylie Minogue has a version of the song, actually, where that is not at the end, and it just does a repeat to fade.
We know why that is, don't we? Because Kylie's a class act.
Well, there we go. But my point being is that subjectively, when you listen to music, there will invariably be bits which, and the bit where I was being a bit loose with the truth is obviously I know I'm not God. I know that my tastes are subjective, and I know what I like is not necessarily what someone else will like. But I'm very aware that what in a song gives me pleasure to bits which doesn't. And I might sort of do a reorganization which actually emphasizes bits which have that speak to me more than other bits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The interesting thing about this is you can't just over repeat the thing that you like, because like any story, there has to be a balance. Sometimes you need the bit you don't like to enjoy the bits you do like. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a puzzle, a personal puzzle that you just play around with until you find an reorganization of a song which actually really fits with what we could call what the kids might call your vibe. And that's kind of what it is. And it's a silly, jokey thing, but in a weird way, it's something which I could see a future market for, because we are all of subjective tastes. We all find, and then do you think, well, could this happen with films as well? Would Doctor Who fans, you know, who could just, you know, have their own, have an app that just sort of sorts out the show in a way they like? They can get rid of the timeless child. They don't want it. Fine. It's out there. You know, this is what I'm just saying is if we are as viewers in a weird way, we are our own authors, aren't we? When we watch something, we author it in our head, what we like, what we don't like, what we think about it, what the subject, what the subtext were. If we are in ourselves authors, I wonder in the future where that will become a bigger thing, where as authors, we will be able to author from in a way that allows us to take content that we enjoy and slightly modify it, and not to sell, not to give out to any people, not to become the ultimate version, but just to tweak things to our own pleasures. If we did, maybe we would have less angry forums and Instagram and TikToks and stuff.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. I think people will. I think what I did with the war games was very similar to what you did with music. I took the elements that really pleased me, and I made something for myself to enjoy. I'm not putting it out there to the world. I'm not disrespecting the one that exists.
Yes, exactly.
It made sense to me. I liked it so much, I wanted to capture it in a way that made perfect sense to me. But with the advent of AI, I mean, there's this one guy that I see pop up a lot on Twitter that he's making he says he is. I've not seen any footage, just screenshots and so on, but he's making an AI version of Doctor Who. That is like this 2-hour movie involving like all the doctors. In fairness, excuse me, I'm probably saying this wrong. I don't think he's doing AI because he showed a video breakdown. The one thing that he did show was he took this shot of David Tennant from Fear Her, where he runs to Rose when she's battling with that scribble ball. And he runs around the corner with the sonic screwdriver. And he did this edit where the first thing he did was take David Tennant out, put him in a completely new background. And then the next pass, he removed that Henley shirt that he was wearing and put him in a regular shirt and tie. And then he changed the color of the suit and the shoes to the blue and the red. And it was really impressive what I saw. So what I said about AI before, I don't know if he's using any AI. I think that's wrong. This is actually CGI. But he is, in essence, making his own film out of existing film. And I don't know how that's going to go. I don't know how the dialogue's going to work. I don't know how anything's going to be, but he's already doing it much to a greater degree than what you or I were doing with the music or this edit that I did here. I've done other edits of Doctor Who before. I've done other things. Matter of fact, I had a friend who he really wanted to see an edit of Peter Davison's Regeneration in a very particular way. Matter of fact, there were two things he wanted me to do to it. And one of them, he wanted to put it to... Oh man, it might've been a Pink Floyd song. I forget who it was. It was a song. And I'm like, you know, I'll do whatever to entertain you. I'll put this together for you. Let's try it. And he really liked the one edit. I think what he didn't like was all the stuff they put in between. He wanted to see like this powerful kind of regeneration just kind of happen kind of thing. So I forget exactly what I did to it, but it's fun to edit those things. I'm not removing the original. I'm not erasing the original. I'm having fun. I'm playing with it. I'm being creative with it. I think my main issue right now is like, let's call up the AI stuff. I'm of two minds of the AI, right? Like I see people doing AI and it looks awful in my opinion, because a lot of times John Pertwee's not quite John Pertwee, Patrick Troughton's not quite Patrick Troughton, but every AI video is the same. It's always people just going, you know, and it's like, you're not moving. It's always that power move. It's never like a talking, it's never dialogue or anything. And it always looks so foreign. They're not doing things the real actors would do. But where I am of the other mind is that the AI is getting so good now. There is a part of me that's like, someone's going to start restoring the missing episodes and syncing the AI video to the existing dialogue. And it's going to get to the point where it looks good enough that I'm probably going to watch that.
I think that's inevitable, really. There is something that's just struck me about this whole kind of like self-authoring of things. And that is, if there is some sort of massive disaster, earth-threatening event, civilizational-threatening event, and only one thing was left, it could be like just one person. It could be like the mysterious planet with, you know, UK habitats of the Canadian Goose by HM Stationery Office has been this version of Doctor Who. There's only one version of Doctor Who that's like survived, or any other TV show, whatever. Take your pick. And it's the version that Brian's curated, or James has curated, or I've curated, or whomever, or Gareth Cavanagh's curated, and it's basically just the Williams era.
It's funny that you should think of it that way, because it's the exact opposite of how I think about it. right?
Okay.
It's a very valid point what you bring up. Some big disaster could happen and somebody could discover the only bit of Doctor Who that exists is this little video that Brian made, right? Whereas I always think about the opposite. I make these things for myself. I keep this archive from myself, these edits, even music edits like James. And like, I think one day I'm not going to be here. And these aren't going to, no one's going to enjoy them. They're going to be gone. They were literally here for me to enjoy. And maybe if someone's sitting beside me on the sofa watching them at the same time too, they might have seen it. But once I'm gone, that's all gone, right? And maybe one day it will survive some kind of apocalypse. But realistically, it's probably just going to be gone when I'm gone.
Can we keep it lighter, lads?
I don't know.
I'm saying it's you know, it.
Yeah, no, it's realistic. It's realism.
I do all of this work. Yeah. It means something to me. Maybe somebody else out there is going to like the edit that I did, but we're not in a world. Yeah. I can't put the edit that I made on YouTube without it getting removed.
Taken down, yeah, sure.
And I was going to say demonetized, but I don't want to make money off of it anyway. That's not even the point. I'd want to put it out there because other like minds might enjoy it. But I can't because more than likely it'll get removed, copyright infringement, right? If nothing else, if the music would be removed from it. I mean, there's one thing I can't stand. I was watching Taskmaster. I was watching Taskmaster on YouTube, and there were a couple episodes where they must have used copyrighted music or music that YouTube thought was copyrighted. And when you're watching it, all the audio drops from that entire scene. You can watch the scene, which you can't hear anything. Mm. And I'm like, well, okay, even if the BBC, for example, wasn't going to remove my edit of the film, the music that's in the scene belongs to somebody and YouTube might remove that. So nobody could watch the edit anyway.
We had an issue with this a few weeks ago on when we did our Mysterious Planet commentary, funnily enough. And the second or third episode had a BBC Worldwide copyright strike on it. And what YouTube did, and basically all it was is because we were playing it in the background, very quiet. All it was the theme tune of Doctor Who that was actually being picked up. So there's an option you can choose now to take the music out, and it just took the music out. So you can still hear James and I talking, but it's took the music out, which is fine. It's good that they've got the technology to do that now. There's stuff I've watched, though. I've watched stuff on YouTube recently, and that was a lot shorter than I remembered it, because whole sections have been taken out due to this process. It's a shame.
But in a sense, it sort of again plays this idea that our world is becoming more fragmented, that, you know, as you said, when you'd watch Star Wars as a kid, you'd watch it, and that in itself could be, as we've said before, edited, cut. RoboCop, if anyone's watched RoboCop as a TV version in the 80s or 90s, hilarious to see what you know, what they dub in, what they cut out. But I feel now we're almost in a place where, thanks to YouTube and the like, we're so used to watching bits of everything that the whole, I don't know, starts to become less important.
Well, this is, I don't know if this is the same thing. Well, it's not, is it? Well, I mentioned this a few weeks ago. I don't know if, Brian, are you familiar with One Foot in the Grave?
Sitcom, right?
Yeah.
Because not 100%, but I think I've seen it.
Yeah. So there's so many big moments and these big memorable things that happen to Victor Meldrew that you kind of assume, I suppose, that they happen over the course of several years. But there's one episode where like three big things happen to him all in the same episode. And I was sat watching this episode the other night, and it was incredible that all these things all happen in the same episode, and they're all laugh out loud things. Now that might be something to do with the quality of writing, obviously, but how you, and again, it comes back to this kind of like this authoring in your head, and how you see a TV show and how you remember the TV show as well, and whether you, or a movie or whatever, and whether you get to see it again. And that's where we'll leave it for this week. If you could make your own definitive edit of a film, TV episode, or piece of music, what would you change? Let us know. You can reply through the Patreon or drop a line to podcasterebus@gmail.com. Thanks for listening to Casterebus. We'll be back soon.